So we're here at the end of the book of Ruth. We've been in this for 8 weeks. I think it's been a remarkable book. And one of the things that's striking to me about the book is how many setbacks and disappointments there are within the story as a whole. And it even starts off with a disappointment. There's a famine in the land, and so Naomi and Elimelech and her family have to move to Moab, enemies of Israel. They have to go live with the enemy in order to provide for their family. That's setback number one. They move to Moab, and we think everything's going to be better. And then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, and their two sons all die. Setback number two. And then Ruth, this is Naomi's daughter-in-law, says, I'll stick with you. I'll go back with you to Bethlehem. And we think things are going to be good. Ruth ends up in a field of a guy that is owned by a guy named Boaz, who cares for Ruth and provides for her. And we think, oh, this is going to turn out so great. And then nothing happens for the rest of harvest season. 6 weeks pass, and nothing happens. And Naomi and Ruth come up with this crazy plan to convince Boaz to become the Redeemer, to marry Ruth. And Boaz responds favorably. And again, we're like, oh, great, this is all taken care of. But he says, but there's another family member that's actually closer to you, closely related to you. And so he needs to have the opportunity to be the Redeemer for you. And so we have, again, another setback. And we come to the town square, the city gate, and there's essentially a law, kind of law firm situation, courtroom, and we find out that this other redeemer, this other family member, does not want to redeem them. Instead, Boaz is given the opportunity, and he takes up. And finally, as we come to the middle part of chapter 4, we have a bit of resolution, where we finally have some sustained positivity happening. And what's striking to me about all this is that God is mentioned only a few times in the book, but we see his orchestrating hand operating all throughout this story. And even though we come to the middle part of chapter 4, where we ended last week, and Ruth and Boaz are slated to be married, and everything seems resolved, there is one part of the story, one aspect of it, where we have not closed all of the loose ends. And that is that there needs to be a continuation of the family. That for Naomi and Ruth to ultimately be fully redeemed, they need to have a son. A son who can carry on the family name and the family property and carry the family forward for generations to come. They need to be able to have a child. And in our society today, a pregnancy announcement is a pretty big deal. It's the way that you proclaim to all of your friends and family, sometimes in person, oftentimes on social media, that you're pregnant and you're going to have a child. And the reason why this is important is I, as a pastor, I often find out from people about special news that they have that they're not sharing publicly yet. And the rule of thumb that I always use is that until somebody's posted about it on Facebook or Instagram, I'm not talking about it ever in front of anybody, because I do not want to be the guy that spills the news in front of somebody else and then I look like the moron that wasn't supposed to say anything. So the pregnancy announcement lets everybody else know, okay, now we can talk about it. It's really important. And because everybody does a pregnancy announcement, everybody wants theirs to stand out. And so people come up with some pretty crazy, creative ideas for sharing about the pregnancy that they have as a couple. And so I thought I'd share some of these really crazy, unique announcements. The first one is this baby who's about to get evicted from the crib because another baby is about to take over the crib. That's pretty creative. I'd give that a solid B+ right there. That's a good one. The next one is a couple who apparently like lowrider trucks, and they have the car seat strapped in the back that says baby on it. I would give this like an A for effort, because that the straps and everything, that took a lot of work, but an F for execution, because what this couple has not figured out is that truck cannot carry that car seat, because that baby cannot be in the front seat of a truck. It's against the law, and they would be in big trouble. So, you know, F on execution, because that guy's going to have to get rid of the truck. The next one, you kind of have to take yourself back to 2020 when toilet paper was like trying to find free-range eggs right now. It was very expensive and hard to do, and so this couple put together a heart with toilet paper rings around it, and in the middle, it's a little hard to see, but it says, "Love is in stock. Number 6 will be coming out of quarantine in January." And I say, when you're up to number 6, you can announce your pregnancy any way you want. Kudos to you. But my favorite one, as I was looking for some pregnancy announcements this week, is the next one, because it needs a little setup. All of you who are parents have done a photo shoot where you had your children try to smile and it all fell apart. And so this couple with 3 kids has number 4 on the way and has 3 kids crying in the picture, and the sign says, "Not again, not again." Number 4, yes. So we get to the pregnancy announcement and birth announcement section of the book of Ruth as we come to the end of the book. And we are in Ruth chapter 4. We're at verse 13. We're going to go to the end of the chapter, which is verse 22. And if you have a Bible, you could follow along, and the words will be on the screen as well. Where we finished off last week was Boaz and Ruth are slated to be married. Boaz is going to be the redeemer, and the town has professed blessings over the two of them. And then in verse 13 it says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than 7 sons, has given him birth.' Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nashon. Nashon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David." And this is the end of Ruth. And this is the word of the Lord for us today as well. One part of this that I just want to draw our attention to that is interesting to me, all throughout Ruth, we've been looking at these chapters that followed short little conversations that sometimes take place over a few hours. Like chapter 2, Boaz approaches Ruth in a field and they have a conversation. Chapter 3 is the night on the threshing floor. The beginning part of chapter 4 is just a short conversation at the city gate. But now in verse 13, it says, "The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son." We have almost a year's length of time in half a verse that just took place right there. And what that half a verse does is it ties up all of the problems that we were presented with at the beginning of Ruth. The problems were that Naomi and Ruth no longer have a family, and they don't have a way to provide for themselves. They don't have food. And so the beginning part of chapter 4 clarifies that they're going to have food. Boaz is going to provide for them. And now we have very clearly, through a marriage and a child, a family that is going to provide for these women. And this is significant because Ruth was previously married. And before her husband died, they could have been married for up to 10 years, which is how long they were in Moab before they moved back. And at no point in those 10 years was Ruth able to have a child. So it's very likely that Ruth is moving back, and even though she's getting married, she probably has doubts about whether she's even able to have children. And so it's significant here that it says the Lord enabled her to conceive. And we see here, though it's often behind the scenes in the book of Ruth, God's goodness poured out in somebody's life. The first time that God is overtly mentioned as doing something, and the only other time in Ruth where God is mentioned as doing something, it is in Ruth chapter 1, verse 6, where it says, "And God allowed the area of Bethlehem to produce food." They had been in a famine, and now they're able to produce food. And so God provided in these specific ways, food and family. He orchestrated it to happen. The Lord is the one who provides for our deepest and most significant needs. That is part of what Ruth is teaching us. And so as we move through our passage here today, verses 13 through 22, we're going to take time examining it as we always do. But I also want to help summarize the book of Ruth as a whole, to look at the whole thing and kind of summarize all of what we've talked about over the last 8 weeks. And to do this, I just have a simple sentence that I want to help finish in a few different ways. The sentence is this: the book of Ruth is a story about, and then we'll finish the sentence. The book of Ruth is a story about, part one, a woman named, now I know this is controversial, but a woman named Naomi. This is a story about a woman named Naomi. Now, I know it's the book of Ruth, and I know we've been talking about Ruth. She's the main character in chapters 2 and 3 and even the beginning part of chapter 4. But we see here at the end a book ending. The book of Ruth started with Naomi in chapter 1. She was the focal point, and the book of Ruth ends with Naomi. She is the focal point. The women of the town say to her, "Praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel." Now, I know that when I'm saying Naomi's the main character, we're kind of splitting hairs, and in some ways I'm being controversial without trying to be. But the point that I'm trying to make is that the book of Ruth is ultimately about how a family line is going to be extended and what significance there is about that. And this is Naomi and her husband's family. This is their family line that is being extended. And at the beginning of the book, because it cannot be extended and family is dying, Naomi is woefully bitter. But because of the Lord's blessing of a child and a marriage around her, now Naomi is wonderfully blessed. We've seen this transformation taking place in her life over the course of these four chapters in Ruth. And the women recognize that this is God's provision in her life. They say to her at the beginning of verse 14, "Praise be to the Lord. It is he who has provided." And notice what they say. That verse continues on. It says, "He has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous." Now, who is the redeemer, and who is it that they're asking to become famous? It's not Boaz. Now, throughout Ruth, Boaz has been the one we've talked about very obviously as the redeemer. But here, at the end of chapter 4, these women are talking about the child who has been born as the redeemer. They're talking about Obed. May he become famous. Obed is the one who will inherit the property that was Naomi's, and then will carry on the family line through Ruth and Boaz. Boaz has very obviously fulfilled his role as the guardian redeemer in the family, preserving the family line. But now as we get to the end of the story, it is Obed who the women say will renew you and sustain you, Naomi. They recognize that it is part of God's unfolding plan from generation to generation that's taking place in what Naomi is witnessing, meaning that Obed's redeemer role extends beyond just his immediate family and continues on. And we see even through the genealogy listed that he'll become the grandfather of David, through whom God establishes an everlasting kingdom. And to understand this, you have to go forward to David being announced and anointed as the king in 2 Samuel 7. God prophesies this over David as he's being announced as the king. 2 Samuel 7:13. He, David, is the one who will build a house for my name, God's name, and I, God, will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So ultimately, this idea of Redeemer is a statement about how David points to Jesus, who is the greater Redeemer, the one who fulfills the promise of salvation for all and makes it accessible and available for all of us. So by the end of Ruth, this term Redeemer, which has been used in very narrow, a technical way, we've talked about this many times, how it's a title, how it has specific roles that a Redeemer was meant to fulfill. Now, at the end of Ruth, we're talking about Redeemer in very broad terms, in terms that make sense to you and I, how we can experience redemption through a Redeemer. And our Redeemer is not Obed. He was a forerunner to Christ, who is our Redeemer, and made himself available to us. And through this, we start to see part of the purpose of why is the book of Ruth even included in the Bible. It's to teach us that in your darkest days, God is still at work. And Naomi experienced a lot of dark days in the 10 years that take place in the book of Ruth. She experienced immense hardship. She seemingly lost everything at the beginning of the book. But now, at the end of the book, through a Redeemer, she has experienced blessing and joy. This book is in the Bible to help us remember and learn that God is at work even in the darkest times of our lives. And so as we finish this part of chapter 4, what we recognize is that all of the loose ends of our story have been tied up. Ruth has a husband, Naomi has a grandson. All of them have been provided for through Redeemers. But the story then continues on. It's almost like, I think of like being at a movie, and the movie finishes and the credits start to roll, and now and then you'll be at a movie and there's scenes that get thrown into the credits to kind of get you to stay in your seat a little bit longer. And what's interesting about the credits, so to speak, of Ruth is that they give us a clue about the significance of everything that's happened before. And so the story, the book of Ruth, is a story about Naomi, yes, but it's also a story, a testimony of God's faithfulness. It's a testimony. It proclaims something, and it does this through the genealogy that's included here at the end of Ruth. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, I know many of you, if you've gone through a Bible reading plan of some sort, you have come up against genealogies that are a part of your Bible reading plan. And you probably do what I often do quite often, and that is skip right to the end and move on to the next thing. Because most of those names, 80, 90% or more of them, mean nothing to us. They're not written about in other parts of the Bible, and so we don't understand their significance. But what we do when we skip over the genealogy is we miss something important, because genealogies are not simply a list of descendants. They're more than that. They bear witness to God's faithfulness from generation to generation. And so the book of Ruth is a story about two widows. And one of those widows is named Ruth. And she is a Moabite woman. She is a foreigner. She is an enemy of Israel. She is an outsider. And she has this unlikely romance that develops with Boaz, an older man. And they get married, and they have a child, and this child eventually leads to the future king of Israel, who eventually leads to the true king of Israel, the Messiah, Jesus. And this is not just surprising to an Israelite Hebrew person reading this story, it would be shocking that a foreigner would be brought into the family and then play such a prominent role would be shocking. But to really understand just how shocking it is, you actually have to read the genealogy included in Matthew 1, which takes the short version included at the end of Ruth, and it makes it much larger. And here's just the section kind of surrounding the genealogy given to us at the end of Ruth. Matthew 1, verses 3 through 6 say this: Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And if you were to continue on many more verses, all the way to the end of the genealogy in Matthew 1, you would have the last person included as Jesus Christ. All of this family is the forerunner to the Messiah. So not only is Ruth included, but there's two other women who are included in this section that I read of the genealogy of Jesus. We have Tamar, who's connected to Judah, who's actually her father-in-law, and through deception allowed Judah to see his sin, his sinful actions, and use them against him and provided an heir through deception and sinfulness. If you read Genesis 38, it is a dark chapter and incredibly disturbing. And God used that to bring about the Messiah. And then you also have another woman included, Rahab. And in the genealogy, she's listed as the mother of Boaz, another one of our main characters. Now, it could be that she was the grandmother or the great-grandmother, because sometimes genealogies would skip generations to give a point of emphasis and highlight specific people. But her inclusion in Boaz's lineage at all would be shocking as well, because Rahab, like Ruth, was a foreigner. She was a Canaanite. She lived in Jericho, and she was known to have an occupation as a prostitute. And in the early part of the book of Joshua, as the Israelites are making their way into the promised land, she provides safe harbor for some spies as they make their way in, as the Israelites are making their way into the promised land. And by faith, she protects them and recognizes God's hand at work. And she's honored for that. Her family is kept safe. They're not taken down by the Israelites as they overcome Jericho. These three women, Ruth and Tamar and Rahab, included in the genealogy of Christ, has something really significant to teach us. And we should take encouragement from their inclusion, because what it reminds us of is that those of us who are sinful, those of us that feel like we're outsiders, those of us that feel like there's not really a place in God's family for us, God says, not only do you get to be a part of my family, but God also says that I am going to build my family through you. You're not only brought into the family, I'm building the family through you. You broken, sinful, outsider, rejected, I'm going to build it through you. And so Matthew 1's genealogy isn't just a list of names. It is a statement about God's grace in our lives. It reminds us that his plan isn't limited by human expectations, by social status, by reputation, that God looks at the heart and he uses people that are seeking after him. The unlikely, the broken, the forgotten. Those are the kinds of people that God uses to accomplish his purposes. And so this ending genealogy, this part of the book of Ruth, it points to God's enduring faithfulness in their lives and now also for us as well. But as we come to the end of the genealogy, there's just one more point really about the story as a whole that I think the book of Ruth invites us into. The book of Ruth is a story about Naomi. It's a story about God's faithfulness, and it's also an invitation to change the world. Now, if you know me, I am very against hyperbole and exaggeration and overstatements. And so that statement, change the world, is a little bit of all of those things at the same time. And that's not really how I go about things. So what am I trying to say? Well, I think it's very obvious that Boaz and Ruth and their marriage and the children that they have change the world, because in their line comes the Messiah. Their marriage has an impact on each and every one of our lives. They changed the world. But what I'm thinking about in that statement, change the world, is they did that, but how? How did they do that? And I think you see it in a statement like what Boaz says to Ruth on the threshing floor as she's proposed to him and says, cover your garment over me. Marry me is essentially what she says. He responds by saying to her, all the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. And just 6 weeks before that time together, they're in the field, and it's the first time Boaz has met Ruth, and they're having a conversation, and Boaz is generous and kind and provides for this woman that he could have easily rejected as a foreigner, as an outsider, as somebody that was beneath him, and he could have pushed her aside, but instead he was kind. And then also at the beginning of Ruth chapter 4, all throughout the book of Ruth, including at the beginning of chapter 4, at the town gate, Ruth has been identified in a specific way as a reminder to us of who she is in the story. She is always described as Ruth the Moabite. Every time she's talked about, it's Ruth the Moabite. As a reminder to us, she's a foreigner, she's an outsider, she doesn't belong where she is. And it's the story's way over and over of emphasizing that. But in verse 13 of chapter 4, you probably missed it because it's so subtle, but it says Boaz took Ruth as his wife. This woman who was an outsider that everybody else around her could have easily rejected, Boaz, through his kindness and his generosity, turned this woman who was Ruth the Moabite into Ruth his wife. Ruth the Israelite, the outsider, is now an insider. She's been brought in, and together they changed the world. But again, how? It was through his kindness and his generosity. He saw something in her that the external circumstances of her lives could not show because she was a foreigner. Nobody else would create space for her. And he saw something in her, so much so that he says to her, all the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. He saw something in her, and he called it out of her and proclaimed it in front of her. And so I think the book of Ruth challenges us. If we want to be the kinds of people that change the world, have an impact on the people around us, we have to think about the lens in which we're viewing them through. Do we see people through the lens of our culture based on appearance, based on reputation and status? Or do we see people like God sees people? People who are longing for hope and for deliverance, longing for God's work to be present in their lives. Do we see people as God sees them, by their character, by their faith, by the image of God that's at work in their lives? And throughout the book of Ruth, we see Ruth interact with people around her with this kind of kindness toward others, especially with Boaz. And with Boaz toward Ruth, he looks beyond her status as a foreign widow, and he instead sees faithfulness and integrity. And Ruth, the outsider who cares for and comes alongside her mother-in-law, Naomi, to be a person of support in a time of extreme loss. This other person focus is so rare in our world today. Everybody is out to make sure that they're taken care of, but it's rare to see somebody who extend themselves in love and care and generosity toward others. What we often do is we judge people by appearances and reputation, but God looks at something deeper, and he invites us to look at people just like that as well, to have an others-focused mentality. It was in 1910, the Salvation Army was preparing to have their annual convention. It was Christmas Eve, and their founder, William Booth, was on his deathbed. And some people came to him and said, oh, it would be really great if you could share a word of encouragement with all of the workers of our organization. Now, we know you can't come, so what if you send a telegram? Now, back then, telegrams were very expensive. You had to pay by the word. So the less words, the less expensive. And he was a frugal guy, and he wanted to save money to leave it for the ministry, to be able to spend it on other needs. And so he thought that he would send a telegram that had one word. And as he sat on his deathbed and he thought through, what is one word that would kind of summarize his ministry and the focus of the Salvation Army to serve and to care? How could he summarize it? And so the day came, the annual convention, and the moderator of the event got in front of the people and told them that William Booth, the founder, would not be coming, that he was unable to join, and that he would be passing momentarily, days left. And there was kind of a hush over the crowd, sadness over all of them. But then he said, but William Booth has sent us a telegram. And what was the one word that William Booth would use to kind of summarize everything that he cared about and wanted to charge all of them to embrace? One word to start off the convention. And the telegram went like this: others. Signed, William Booth. Others. Others. And I think that is reflective of the mentality of Jesus. When Matthew 20 said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the mentality of Christ. And what you and I need is people around us like that, that can see us as God sees us and call out what's happening that we sometimes have a hard time seeing. I am here in this role in part because there were people that saw something in me that I could not see myself and called it out as really becoming the voice of God in my life that led me to embrace where I am now, in large part because of the role that they played. You can look around this room right now. This room is full of people who aren't sure they're doing good enough. This room is full of people with self-doubt, with self-frustration, wondering if they have what it takes to meet the challenges of life. And it's very easy for each of us to start doubting whether God's goodness could actually come true in our lives. Do I really have what it takes? Am I really good enough for God to use to love me and to care for me? We go through those doubts and questions all the time. And what we need is for somebody else to look at our lives and to call out what God is actually doing and what is actually inside of us. And then subsequently, we need to be the kinds of people that see those things in others and call them out. That's what Ruth and Boaz did to each other. There was a mutual affirmation of God's work in each of their lives toward each other. And that simple thing, that simple statement of an ordinary action changed the world. How they treated each other brought them together and allowed their line to now have an impact on us as well. It's the same mentality Jesus had. In Matthew 9, it says he saw the crowds as they were harassed and helpless, and he had compassion on them. He had compassion on them. And that next verse leads in to the name of our church, New Harvest Church. The harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. And part of what I think that verse is getting at is who are the people of compassion that will look out toward others, see God in them, and to call it out, the thing that they can't see, to call it out of them. Everyone around you is thinking that they're not good enough. And they need somebody to become the voice of God in their lives to show them God's work that is happening in and through them. As we close out our time, there were three themes in Ruth that to me were so impactful and that we talked about almost every week. The three themes are valor, kindness, and providence. Valor was the Hebrew word ha'il. It was described to Boaz in Ruth chapter 2, and it was described to Ruth in Ruth chapter 3. It's a word that means valor, character, integrity, standing. a reputation of godliness and obedience. The second theme, kindness. This is from the Hebrew word hesed. It's loyal, faithful love and care toward others. We see it in Ruth pursuing Boaz. He says, this hesed, this kindness is greater than what you gave to your mother-in-law by sticking by her side. It seeks out and cares for and is generous to others. And then the last theme that we've talked about a lot is providence. Providence is God exercising his sovereignty, his power, his authority. He's exercising those things through the natural, ordinary circumstances of our lives. So how do these three things kind of fit together? That's been the question that's been running through my mind all week long, is how do these themes that we've spent time focusing on, how do they come together and then have an impact on our lives? And here's a long sentence, I'll give you that, a long sentence that I thought of that I think kind of captures the three of these things coming together. God is weaving his story of redemption through ordinary people like you and me, who choose to live with valor, integrity, character, honesty before the Lord and others, and who choose to see others with kindness, to see them the way God sees them, with care, with love, and with generosity. And when people live with valor and kindness before God and with others, through his faithfulness, he allows them to leave a legacy that far exceeds their days, a legacy that leads to an extraordinary life that changes the world. It's a simple thing to change the world. It really is. Care for the people around you. Jesus is the ultimate example of that, who willingly gave his life so that our lives would be changed. And can we then sacrificially give back to him by caring for those